There are many authors who have appeared on this program. Some have scurried away while others have appeared twice. But now, there's a new author type. T.C. Boyle is the first author to appear three times on the Bat Segundo Show. What this means exactly, we cannot say. We wish we could offer a trip for two to Machu Picchu, or a Cuisinart that falls apart 6 months after its purchase, or perhaps a back rub or a dutiful snog from a stranger. But we can't, because we haven't thought that far ahead, and there isn't a magical elixir in the medicine cabinet that can presently aid us in our long-term planning. So I am here once again with T.C. Boyle, who is now, most recently, the author of The Woman. Tom, how are you doing?
Doing great, Ed, although there's a slight bit of jet lag creeping in.
Ah.
But I know how to restore that.
How do you restore that?
Smoke a lot of crack.
Really? Okay.
No. I think a little bit of caffeine will help.
A little bit of caffeine. Have you had any caffeine yet today?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So we'll be as gentle as we can. In fact, there was one time I talked with you and I didn't have any caffeine, so now we're even, I think.
Oh, so yeah, you're all cranked up.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm going to just catch it from you because I don't want to do too much of that because I have 1,000 interviews to go through today and then a show tonight. So
yeah, absolutely.
I'll wait.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I actually wanted to open up this conversation with a very unusual question relating to Ellen Key. There was, your book got me curious, of course, about Ellen Key again, and I dragged up this particular quote from the Woman Movement, which was, of course, translated by Mema.
Yes.
And it was, "A wife has decided to give up a vocation which she saw was not compatible with her home, but she still finds no rest. She is harassed by the demand of the spirit of the time that a married woman should be able to take care of the house as well as to accomplish outside personal work. And I found this quote and I said, wow, this is rather fitting in light of the spirit of the time of your particular novel and the role of the woman in Frank Lloyd Wright's life.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, how is this book in particular about the spirit of the time? Is it more about the spirit of the time than it is about Frank Lloyd Wright, the individual? And we can go into the crazy structure you whipped up, but I wanted to start from here.
Well, what a great question. And I love the fact that you went back to Ellen Key. I had never heard of Ellen Key before I began to research this book. But yeah, obviously, that quote and others that I incorporate in the book have to do with a kind of feminism that was new to our society at that time. But to go back to answer the question at large, I don't think so exactly. I think it has to do certainly with feminism and the role of women in the life of this one creative genius.
Yeah.
My interest is something you'll know about from my previous books. Particular ones in which I've taken on great egomaniacs of the 20th century, like John Harvey Kellogg and most recently Alfred C. Kinsey. I wonder, what is the cost to the acolytes, whether those acolytes are male or female? But in this case, in particular, the intimate acquaintances of the great genius and how he might use them to his own advantage or discard them and so on. And in the case of Frank Lloyd Wright, it seems that each of his wives was progressively more sophisticated. He was looking for complication. He was looking for a kind of ratification in who he was. Of course, he was not educated beyond, despite what he says, beyond about 2 semesters of college. And each of these women had her own agenda, which I found fascinating.
And Miriam, I know, didn't receive any college education. So it's interesting also the education in the woman that he was with as well.
Right, but of course, Mema had been college educated, and so had Olgivana, or at least she'd had a very strong education to begin with. Miriam, though, was coming from 10 years in Paris, so she was this incredible exotic in terms of fashion and sophistication.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Miriam, I mean, this is the particular woman who stands out the most. Every time she enters the equation, all of a sudden, you amp up the prose. It becomes hyper-caffeinated Boyle, I would say. And at the same time,
she stole the book, Ed.
She did steal the book.
She stole my heart. She was a ready-made, larger-than-life comic character who was every bit his equal in terms of egomania and desire for attention.
Yeah, but the question, however, is, okay, certainly she did very terrible things. There are a lot of interior questions that come up every time she enters into enters onto stage. But I'm wondering if you're being entirely fair to the tragedy of her particular character. I mean, I know you have said in previous interviews that you view art as entertainment, and certainly Miriam is an entertaining character. But simultaneously, if you don't focus entirely on the tragedy and you view her as a cartoon, is this truly being fair to the artistic process of rendering the character?
I don't view her as a cartoon, and I think you should have sympathy for her. But of course, in a work of art, the reader has to enter it and create his or her own engagement with these characters, so that everything that Miriam does in this book, and some of what she says, in fact, is quoted from the press of the day. So this is what she did. This is who she is. My object is to dramatize her, not necessarily to make her a figure of fun, but also a tragic figure as well, because she doesn't get what she wants. What does she want? What does she want to be him, you know? And I find that this is the case sometimes with people in my own life,
yeah.
You know, who come very close. Fortunately, my own wife does not want the limelight, and I couldn't imagine living, like writers who are married to other writers,
yeah.
That would last for me about 10 minutes before I choked her to death. So opposing Miriam and Frank was very interesting for me as a novelist to see the depths of their attraction and the polarities that resulted. So I don't see her as a comic figure. She stole the book for me because she was triumphantly crazy. I mean, just absolutely crazy. And to me, that was that's great drama.
Yeah.
But I do think you should feel for her, especially as her story winds down at the end of the first section, because she invested so much psychological energy in trying to be the grande dame and didn't succeed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of comparing Miriam to the other woman in Frank Lloyd Wright's life, I mean, there is, of course, also the risk that because Miriam stands out as much as she does and steals the book, that in terms of balancing this against the other woman, she's almost too good a character in relation to the other woman. I mean, was this a concern as you were writing this, trying to balance this?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. In fact, the structure of the book, which suggested it suggested itself to me early on, is a way of dealing with that. Since I'm telling the story backwards, I can end the book by bringing Miriam back.
Yes.
So that we get a circle going all the way around. And of course, I think old Giovanna was every bit Miriam's equal in terms of her eccentricities and her desire to be the grande dame, which of course she was for the next 40 years. And I think I addressed that, though, through Tadashi's introductions. He's giving us what happened after all of this tumult of Frank Lloyd Wright's life. Once he married Il Giovanna, then he settled down to become the grand man until his death in 59. I mean, he was that's 39 years more.
Yeah.
And so I think Tadashi gives you a view of Il Giovanna that you would not otherwise get. And he didn't know Miriam personally, so he can only suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing, too, is that the first part of the book has A-B-A-B narrative, and I had to ask whether you had been caught in a particular routine, because Talk Talk, of course, is an A-B-A-B narrative, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if, of course, you get to the second part and you're out of the A-B-A-B narrative, but I'm curious if this was a vestige from writing Talk Talk, how that came into being.
Ed, you're a penetrating man, and I like your questions. It ain't that complex. Each story that I do is organic. And it suggests itself to me as it evolves. I don't really worry about whether I'm going to oppose characters in different chapters. And there is some of that, of course, in this book. But, for instance, the last book about a great figure like this was the Kinsey book. And
sure.
It was a fairly straightforward first-person narrative of an acolyte talking about his relationship to the master. I just didn't want to repeat myself. And so I discovered a new form altogether. And there were times when it was convenient for me or important for me to represent Frank Lloyd Wright's point of view, but that was not my main object. My main object was to represent him through the eyes of the women. And also, again, the structure of the book allows me to have a lot of fun in a Nabokovian sense with the authority of a narrative. What is a narrative? Who is the author of this? What is the truth? Because what is the truth of biography? You know, the biographies that I list in the beginning and memoirs of Frank Lloyd Wright were huge, hugely important to me. And yet, each one varied somewhat in its details, just as each history will vary in its details. So by having Tadashi purportedly writing this, we get a whole other dimension of what narrative is. And of course, the joke for me, and in the footnotes, is how much English does Tadashi know? When he delivered his memoirs to O'Flaherty's son, his grandson-in-law, the Irish-American novelist, whose books are a little suspect.
Yeah, who hasn't been published.
Who hasn't been published. He's very surprised by what the narrative is, because obviously it has been novelized by O'Flaherty-san, which is a convenient trick for me because I am novelizing this life too. So all of those layers gave me tremendous fun and spun this narrative in a different direction from a more conventional telling.
Yeah.
And again, the conventional telling of every biography, almost every biography, begins with the great-grandparents. And, you know, by the time you get to the birth of the star, you're already bored. And I just want to turn all that on its head. You know, I'm always interested in fooling with form.
Yeah. I guess it seems that you've been a victim of Robert Caro's books, because it takes forever before we actually get to the beginning of LBJ in those many volumes.
Absolutely. But, you know, there are different ways of doing it. Yeah. There are biographers like Blake Bailey, whom I really, really enjoy. I've read and blurbed his Cheever book, which I love. He's great. He's like a novelist. He begins where he wants to in order to frame a dramatic narrative. And so there are ways of doing it, but I would say 99% of biographies, you know, are going to give you the chronological order.
But there's also a question with this narrative structure of how much we actually know Frank Lloyd Wright, because we have, of course, this narrative, which is being in turn reinterpreted by the O'Flaherty son, and then on top of that, he was never there to view any of these incidents. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, well, it's from the point of view of the woman. And it's never actually directly from Frank Lloyd Wright himself. So this is rather interesting because it also reflects the many Tribune reporters. There's a Tribune reporter in all three parts. You're almost suggesting here that, well, we not only do we not know who this guy is, but perhaps it's not even important to know who he is. And I'm curious as to whether you as a novelist, or even Tadashi as a novelist, or the reader can even hope to know who Frank Lloyd Wright is. And this leads me to wonder, what is then the point of having the book in the first place?
God, Ed, what a great analysis. I love it. Yeah, all of that. I ratify all of that. Again, I went into the project wanting to know more about the guy who built my house. You know, I mean, people asked me about it. I knew something of prairie style. Now I've become an expert. Yeah. That was one of my objects. Whenever I like something or dislike something, I explore it and make it into a story. That's just the way my brain works. Again, I'm always looking for a new way in. And the way in here is as you describe it. Frank Lloyd Wright is central to all the action. He is what this is about. If you don't know anything about his architecture, you will learn about his life and architecture by reading this book, just as you would from reading a biography. But I'm far more interested in his effect. His effect on us today, his effect on the people around him. And also, what interests me is we're both artists, and of course the essential metaphor here is, you know, building a novel is very much like building a house. It's very much the same kind of process. You dream, you see something, you devise a plan, whether it's on paper or structurally in your head, and you put the final bricks in and the last page, and that's it. It's built. It's a structure. I just wondered how this is done, how he might have done it, how I might have done it, what the parallels are, and what are the distinctions between us. And one obviously is that what I do doesn't require interaction with anybody and doesn't require anybody to fund me. I don't need a patron. But he needed patrons in order to make what he saw. And so he had to become a con man.
Yeah. But the question of this effect, however, I mean, if we don't know the cause, if we have only a shadow as to the root cause, if we have only hearsay, if it's a game of telephone, essentially, or in this case, I suppose, Japanese whispers, then how on earth can we even possibly begin to understand the notion of that effect if it is essentially constant hearsay?
Well, I guess the suggestion is, as you said quite brilliantly in your last question, the suggestion is, what do we know? What do we know about history, or biography, or the past, or anybody, for that matter? I'm really having a lot of fun with that notion, in the way I suppose Nabokov has with his recreation of his poet in Pale Fire.
Yeah. You know?
And again, if you look all the way back to my first book, Water Music, it was a sort of conscious attempt to examine what history is and how we receive history and how do we know about it. So I guess it's something I've been working with from the beginning.
Yeah, but I mean, in the Inner Circle and the Road to Wellville, we have a very specific cause and effect relationship because the details are, well, even though it is a novel, we have very specific motivations behind those details, even if we don't have all the answers.
You're asking what are Franklin Wright's motivations?
Yeah, well, but the thing is if
his motivation was to be a great hero of the world. Truth against the world was his motto, as if he were constantly being neglected or attacked, his back was against the wall. This is how he created. His desire was to make art, but his way of going about it was to create tumult as well. He couldn't work without tumult. So I think you identify that in him. As far as giving, I think you get the same kind of portrait of him that you would get of John Harvey Kellogg or of Kinsey in this particular book. You know what he wants.
Yeah.
He wants to make great art and to impose it on everybody, get paid for it, and blow the world away.
Yeah.
He wants to be a celebrity, and he is, you know?
Well, that much I understand. The question is because we're seeing it through a sliver and through a constantly filtering prism, the question is do we really know the details? I guess what I'm wondering is this really an effective way to examine these motivations, or is the novel in itself a suspect medium, you know? So
well,
therefore, we maybe well, the question
is. Well, of course it is. Of course it is a suspect medium. It's a game. It's a seduction. It's my vision of something that seduces you into believing that it's true. And you're believing that it's true on many levels, but as you've already said, you know, it's a narrative from the point of view of women and who should know about them. How does Tadashi know? How does O'Flaherty-san know? All of that, I think, I leave to the reader to supply. That's what good art is supposed to do. It's supposed to be interactive. It's supposed to invite you in. You know, you might recall I wrote a book called Riven Rock, 98.
Yeah.
98. And in it, I had studied the psychiatric record of Stanley McCormick and his wife, Catherine Dexter, and they did not consummate their marriage, as far as I could determine. And people would ask me, so how do you know? And I would say, well, because I wrote the book. That's how I know. You know, in some way, as I'm sure you're aware, even though Frank Lloyd Wright is one of the most celebrated, you know, American heroes ever. The figure I've heard is there are something like 1,000 books have been written about him and his work. Nonetheless, he becomes my character. They all become my characters, as Miriam does, as you suggested. And some, of course, have greater valence than others, because when you're building a drama, you have to know whom to include and whom to exclude.
Yeah. Well, to touch upon this further, I should point out on a sentence level that you often introduce a sentence. First of all, there are more dashes in this book than many of your books, I should point out.
I like parenthetical information.
But there is a lot of parenthetical information. In fact, I want to read you one sentence.
And we get parenthetical of parenthetical because we have the footnotes.
Yes, exactly.
And the way I read the footnotes, by the way, is as a parenthesis. Mm-hmm. I don't read to the end of the line. I jump there to the bottom. And I had a hard time, by the way, fitting them all in the bottom. And I insisted that they must be on the bottom of the page and not drift over for that reason.
I got it. Well, I mean, well, here's a typical sentence. They all gathered in the lobby like dogs early the next morning. Which, okay, fine, regular sentence. And then you put the comma, dutiful dogs with their teeth sharpened and a smell of the meat wagon on the air. And she held herself erect, struggled briefly with her face, and the sentence goes on and on.
Continue it, Ed. It's so beautiful at this hour in the morning. It's just what I want to hear.
Okay, struggled briefly with her face, with her mouth and chin and the emotion welling up like a geyser there because this was her life, her very life she was fighting for, and let them all know how Frank Lloyd Wright had betrayed and abused her and how he was living in defiance of a court order with his foreign concubine in the house that was as much hers as his, and how she was facing eviction from her modest rooms even as she stood there before him. That is a good deal of information.
That is so beautiful, Ed. God, you're sweeping me away.
Well, I wanted to bring up this sentence, because the last time we talked, I quibbled over one of your sentences. This time, I actually want to praise this sentence and point out how it relates to this notion of an ever-shifting prism. Because we're presented with an initial set of information, it then wends and divagates its way into another set of information before we go more and more and more and more, which is why I suggest to you that, what is ultimately the purpose if we don't have clear motivations? Because even the translator, so to speak, who is depicting this particular information is having some difficulties pinpointing something precise, as well as the annotations which you just mentioned.
Of course, that sentence, and others like it, is my attempt to replicate the thought process of what is going through her head in a flash like that when she's getting ready. And of course, it does have its comic elements.
Yes. Yes. But
and again, you know, I do feel for her. But back to your initial question, a sentence like that, this is what her inner tumult is. This is what she's thinking. This is how she's preparing herself to face these people. And she has warring emotions at that moment, as we all do.
Got you. But I guess the question is, well, is it a scenario in which this book is essentially the rest is commentary? That really the annotations, the footnotes, represent hasty biographical sketches that often get us further away from the truth of who Frank Lloyd Wright is. We get these little details that, yes, they're absolutely interesting and all that, but simultaneously, well, you know, hey, aren't you actually going to be coming to terms with the fact that, well, this guy was extremely cruel to his workers and the like?
Yeah, I think that any reader will see his faults and see his godlike, drifting over all of us mere mortals. But you don't want to be hammering the nail every single minute.
Yeah.
I think you get that portrait of him very clearly through this. I'm not at all letting him off the hook. As with Kinsey and as with Kellogg, I admire these people for what they've created and what it's brought to us today.
Yeah.
You know? On the other hand, I want to also demystify this notion of who they are and give a sense of them as human beings. And again, all the way back to what I said earlier, what is the effect on the people around them? Art stands above morality. I don't care, if you rape babies. If you write a book that blows me away, then I think it's great art, or create a building that blows me away. And yet, what interests me, or what interests any biographer, is any biographer will come into a biography with an admiration for the work. But what the biographer really wants to know, what fans really want to know, is who is the creator of this, and what is he like? How is he like me?
Well, it seems to me then that there's almost a satirical impulse here, because on one hand,
well,
I'm the arch,
a satirist.
Well, of course,
but
of course.
I try to get it both ways.
Yeah, yeah.
I try to get it both ways. I try to involve you in something in a satiric way, and yet it should also move you. And of course, in this book, I had to do that because of the tragedy of Mema, which will conclude the book. So you have to set the reader up for that throughout. And I think there is tragedy throughout the book. Tadashi's life is incredibly tragic in many, many regards. So again, I'm playing one element against the other throughout. And there is commentary upon commentary upon commentary. And for me, it opened up the structure and it made it fun. It made it invigorating. I mean, a lot of the footnotes exist to give you information that I would like you to know about Frank Lloyd Wright and his buildings and where he was and what he did at a given time. But a lot of them also just express surprise on the part of Tadashi, and I find them hilarious.
Yeah. Well, the question, though, is, okay, if the reader wants to know about the artist, and essentially you believe, your own particular view is, the art should stand above any morality, this is interesting because we don't know about the artist, and simultaneously, well, you do have many details about Taliesin, and as well as the skies and the views and all that. But I'm curious if this almost runs counter to the impulse, if you're almost playing with the reader expectation so that they will never know about the artist, even though this is in fact why they read your books, and whether that's entirely fair to the reader.
Well, don't forget that when I am creating art, I don't mean to be fair to the reader or unfair to the reader.
Yeah.
Those questions lie right outside the parameters of what I'm doing. I'm dreaming something and I'm creating something for my own purposes. I deliver it to you and I hope that you interact with it in some way. And obviously you do and other readers do. Sophisticated art, to my mind, doesn't provide answers and doesn't have an agenda other than art itself. So that I think a book like this one, of all my books, is probably the one in which the reader will be most engaged to try to unravel the truth of what it is in its own right. And don't forget, I'm not writing about an unknown figure here. Kinsey was, as you know, was recognizable second only to the president in this country in his time. But by the time I wrote about him, everyone had completely forgotten who he is. No one knows who he is. And Kellogg, too, was lost in the mists of history. But again, Frank Lloyd Wright, there's been 1,000 books. There's a cult. I mean, people are lined up in, you know, in Chicago today, freezing to get in and go on the tour. So this is someone who has been written about eternally and is very well known.
Yeah.
My interest is, how do I get a new angle on this?
Yeah. So by him being more well known than Kinsey or Kellogg, you can then, I suppose, justify this notion of not knowing Frank Lloyd Wright. That's what you're saying, of the reader
if,
not knowing.
If this is your interpretation, I would say yes. But again, I think you do know him. You do see him from his point of view a few times, but I didn't want to represent his point of view a great deal, because then you know his motivation and you know what he's thinking. I would rather have it, that's why I called it The Women.
Yeah.
I'd rather have him viewed from other perspectives, so that you can make your own determination. And yes, I think part of that determination is that he was incredibly narcissistic, maybe one of the most narcissistic people who ever lived. And that narcissism, as we talked about with regard to Peck Wilson in Talk Talk, can be very damaging to everybody around you. I like to hope and think that I am sympathetic to people whom I meet people who are close to me, and that far from damaging them, I might even be aiding them in some way.
Yeah.
A narcissist like Frank Lloyd Wright, though, or Kinsey, or Kellogg, doesn't view the world in that way. Everybody else is simply valuable only as they fit into his regime. So I think any reader, even the least sophisticated reader of this book, will have a portrait of Frank Lloyd Wright that may be more true than what you'll get from a biography.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because I actually want to bring up, here's a really elaborate question. One of the great tragedies of this book is, of course, the cruelty, which we had alluded to earlier, that Frank Lloyd Wright eked out upon the people who worked for him. For example, you know, aside from, you do have a few aspects of revolt. You have, of course, Nellie Breen, who again uses the Mann Act as a blackmail device.
All true, by the way.
Yeah,
this is
yes,
all entirely
it is true.
How
it
could
is,
you make
it
this
is,
stuff
I
up?
Know.
It's great.
You have Herbert Moll, who does leave, and then is persuaded to come back.
He's an invented character, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, there are many apprentices like this.
Yeah. But you also have, for example, Tadashi, like Gatsby, his Daisy is taken away from him.
Exactly.
And then he's also...
good comparison.
Well, you use Daisy, but he quietly observes the suffering, humiliations, and deprivations of basic human rights at the internment camps, but he's not entirely willing to confess those same horrors with Ryota-san. And so I have to ask, if it's self-evident that Wright was indeed a cruel guy, what of these notions of revolting? Was it just, are you just essentially trying to observe that it's essentially one individual trumping other individuals? I mean...
I think it makes Tadashi a much more complex character, because part of the drama of that is created by this structure is that as he reads through this and writes his footnotes, he is reevaluating his relationship with the master. And he is not about, because of his own character, his personality, and also his cultural roots, to attack the master. And yet he does ask questions, at the end of the first introduction. Was this the great Raito-san whom we shouted bonsai to in the streets? What about the people around him? What about the women? So he is reevaluating. And I think there's an essence of tragedy in that, and it makes him a more complex character from my point of view than someone who would finally turn against Frank Lloyd Wright and say that he destroyed my life and he used me for his own purposes. We don't quite get that. And I think it makes it more interesting. It's less definitive, and he doesn't have an axe to grind. In fact, his intention in doing this is to celebrate the master.
Yeah.
But it's much more insidious, because he's not even aware of it, but creeping into this narrative throughout are his criticisms of the master.
Yeah,
but not in an overt way.
But with Miriam at the end saying, "What a poor, poor man," it's almost as if empathy into a narcissist is the inroads to understanding the artist. And simultaneously, while we don't know who he is, and these characters in their blindness put up with a lot of despicable actions. So this is why I bring up this question of whether this really comes down to, well, the artist is held above morality, above everything else, and you have individuals attempting to negotiate into that particular web, and they fall squarely under it because they're unable to exert themselves. And it's almost as if you're suggesting to the reader that, okay, well, here we are. You can understand, going back to the theory we established before, you could try to understand the artist, but you won't, particularly if you get squashed under his thumb.
I like that. I love this interpretation. And people are attracted to dynamic figures, and in this case, in the arts. And you know, obviously, in taking on an artist now instead of two scientists like Kellogg and Kinsey, I'm equating this, of course, with my own experience as an artist and becoming a celebrated artist over these years. And people with whom I come into contact. And what is the result of that? What do they want? And ultimately, as I said earlier, I think what they want is to be you. You know, the personal assistant, the various wives, whoever it is. They identify so much with the art. And of course, the power that that art creates for the individual who created it. They want to absorb it. They want to cannibalize it. They want to be it somehow, and yet they are not the artist.
Yeah. That this is the
The acolytes.
This is the overwhelming streak that destroys American culture, in your view, perhaps? This notion of wanting to be a follower as opposed to an individual voice or a distinct person or finding what one is good at in life? Or...
Yeah, you put it pretty well. it has to go back to our roots.
Yeah.
Or my roots. You know, no one ever said no to me. I was a punk all my life. I'd just done what I like.
Yeah.
I don't associate with other people artistically. I couldn't imagine working on a film or doing anything other than doing exactly what I want. I don't go to meetings. I don't do anything. I just do what I want. And I'm always very suspicious of authority and especially of fanship. Now, I admire hugely, worship. This worship isn't the right word. I admire hugely, and I'm a fan of many, many artists of different stripes. But I'm not worshipful, because I'm an individual,
yeah.
And I have my own agenda and my own life. I couldn't subsume my desires in someone else's. And yet I see people come to me and subsume their desires in mine. I try, though, not to use them and not to advocate. I don't want people to do anything. I just create art. And I'm happy if I can communicate with them in that way. But all the rest of it, I don't need acolytes. I don't need slavery. I don't need people worshiping me. I don't want it.
Yeah.
You know?
Although
but
you
Frank
do like
Lloyd
to be...
Wright did.
Yeah. Although you do like to be cruel within the art, which is quite interesting. I'm curious as to what extent do you admire
satire,
cruelty?
Satire yeah. has to be cruel to a degree. It's not a corrective exactly. But it holds up to the light something that is ludicrous or is perhaps wrong or reprehensible in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I mean, that's... But, you know, some of my early heroes, like Evelyn Waugh, for instance, is one of the most hilarious writers who ever lived and is a savage satirist. But he only tore down.
Yeah.
I was hoping in my career to be able to do something like that, but also to build as well.
Well, Tom, it was a pleasure chatting with you again. Thanks so much for taking the time out.
A pleasure as always, Ed, and I really enjoyed your caffeinated buzz. You woke me up.
Woman, I can hardly express my mixed emotions at my thoughtlessness.